David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to episode 375 of the Marvel Noise Podcast. I'm your host, make that ringleader, Steve Raker, accompanied by my usual circus of crime, Worldwind X Kevin, and Andrew the LA Rabbit. What's up, guys?
See, I was going to go the whole Skrull angle, but then you threw in the whole circus of crime, so that works too.
And why the nicknames, you ask? Well, yeah, they were our handles back on the old Bullpen Bulletins, Marvel Noise, and 11 O'Clock Comics message boards back in the day. And a karma kiss for anyone who remembers.
I guess that makes me the clown, right? Or am I one of the great Gambonos?
Now, we usually pull this stunt for episodes that are like 100 or that end in 50. But for episode 375, we've decided to cover every Marvel issue 375.
Oh, these must be the good ones.
Spoiler, there's only 8, so that's not too bad.
And no Conan. And soon, someday.
They go back to the original numbering, maybe.
Yeah, right.
What about Thunderbolts or New Warriors, Kevin?
Yeah, no.
And we will see that every issue 375 isn't exactly treated as a milestone. In fact, I think only half of the books treat 375 as something special. But this episode of Marvel Noise is. Marvel Noise first debuted on September 19th, 2007, which makes this episode our 14th anniversary, but more importantly, making the start of our 15th year podcasting. So that's cool.
Yeah.
We're going to have to do something special for next year.
I'm trying to work backwards, like, when did I start listening and all that stuff.
I was told there would be no math.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, how does that work? And then I'm like, what? And then you passed your anniversary for the show.
Thanks, as always, to our founder and the original host, David A. Price, and the grand poobah of the Deliberate Noise Network, Derek Coward, for all their time and effort to make and lay the groundwork, working behind the scenes, too, to make this podcast what it is today.
We need more segments where we're in the car.
With the windshield wipers going in the rain, splattering off the glass. The occasional bout of road rage. Don't forget to check out our sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise, where the road rage flies free, which is also on the Deliberate Noise Network, and you can hear us talk about indie books. And Marvel Noise? Well, what are we? We're the semi-monthly podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. You can find, listen to, stream, and download episodes past and present over on marvelnoise.com. Get new episodes announcements and see images and cover galleries. You can even poke us if you'd like on our Facebook and Twitter pages. It's also just a few weeks now until the Baltimore Comic Con, October 22nd, 23rd, and 24th at the Baltimore Convention Center, right in the Inner Harbor Zone. It is going to be a proof of vaccine and masks from last I heard. But the Baltimore Comic Con is... it's the comic-centered show, full of fantastic guests and artists. It's one big, giant artist alley. There's a substantial and still growing guest list, which you can see and get tickets and other info at BaltimoreComicCon.com. My pals Mike Spring and Jim Whiting, that I'm traveling with, are both tabling at the show. So look them up on Artist Alley, because that's where I'll be sitting down and putting up my feet. Come say hi. See you in Baltimore. All right.
Parachute in.
8 issue 375.
I can't help but hear the Frank Zappa Steve that yeah. you always use.
It's such a good anthem.
It is. It's they the show itself, if they wouldn't get sued by the estate, should use it.
We have 8 issue 375s, the first of which hit in the fall of 1986, which wow. was Thor 375.
Yeah, anything before the 90s, you're pretty sure it's not going to be some crazy spectacular.
Hey, I probably read this off the rack, shelf, subscript, whatever I was getting comics in 86. Ow. This would have been Andy buying comics.
I don't think I've ever seen this one before.
I dropped out earlier that year. I didn't make it to the fall of 86. But this was written by Walt Simonson with art by Sal Buscema. And I love you, Uncle Walt, but it's an awfully composed Simonson cover. It's really muddy color palette, and the figure work is strange. The composition is weird. It's weird.
Is that the original cover? Like, we get into this remastering, recoloring debate, and I'm like,
afraid so.
I guess that's the colors look really off this time.
So, no, Walt, as far as the art inside, but I think Sal really did good work on this series, carrying on some of, like, Simonson's artistic sensibilities, the armor designs, the way that the clothing hangs off people, some of the lines he was using, and using tricks like reverse silhouettes and stuff in the background when to put characters further back. I think Sal did some really good work on this.
I always like Sal, but I think later on I've come to appreciate more. I picked up, I think, that Hulk Sal Buscema. They did IDW has those little kind of red slipcase volumes of, like, focusing on artists and everything. And it's been nice to go back now that I'm older and kind of just appreciate, you know, he was there for so long.
Yep.
And so many different eras. I think some people are just like, yeah, you know, he's fine or whatever. So it's nice for me to kind of really bask in it and appreciate how I feel like I can't recall ever, at a minimum, storytelling is always rock solid, which yeah. I think is underrated in comics. I think there's a lot of ones where you know, they have a lot of style, but you're not always sure necessarily the flow of the action and what's happening.
And here he's inking his own work, which is unusual.
See, I look at this, and I just see Spectacular Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Like, the Man-Beast shows up, and then I'm like, Vermin?
Yep, yep. And this is the era in Thor when he was cursed by Hela, and his bones were brittle. He busted his arm, so at the beginning of this ish, he goes to see Tony Stark to, like, build him a brace, like a cast.
He had Hella brittle arms, Steve. This storyline, I thought, was a little, I don't want to say belabored. How do I focus it? It made it hard at times to always stomach. I think they would have just been better saying he couldn't heal. Because it's hard for me to believe. I remember reading these thinking he's taking the regular kind of pounding. And if they're brittle, he would have had all his bones broken already. Yeah. They should, if they had just made it where he couldn't heal, it would have been just as bad and more believable rather than, oh, I just twisted so it didn't, like, you know, you get punched by any of these dudes with brittle bones, they're all broken. So, it wasn't thrilled. I think Walt could have gotten away with, like, hey, he can't heal. And then you could have more beat up each issue and everything.
It goes somewhere plot-wise, though, because this leads to him getting that mystical golden armor forged that changed his look for a while there. Well, you know, this is the time when in the other books they had played around with changing, you know, who Cap is, changing who Iron Man was. And so rather than, you know, they changed Thor a little bit with the Beta Ray Bill, but they changed Thor's look big time by finally giving him a beard and putting him in golden armor.
Well, but, I know your boy Thunderstrike is coming, Steve, so hang on.
That's several years off, fortunately. But
we're going to do that series?
We'll touch upon him later. Loki's all pissed because he helped Asgard defeat Surtur, and he's no closer to holding any power, so he sets off to beguile Thor by transforming ordinary mortals into semblances of Thor's rogues gallery. So first it's the man-beast, that creation of the High Evolutionary, then the Wrecker, and finally Thor faces the Absorbing Man, thinking it's another helpless mortal being used as a pawn, but spoiler, it's the real McCoy, and he beats down Thor so bad that that becomes the catalyst for getting the golden armor forged. And but the Asgardian scenes in this issue are great, too. This Frandrel and Hogan helping some kids out, and Heimdall having a light-hearted moment with the Enchantress. That's funny. Mm-hmm. It's a solid ish for being under such an ugly cover.
Yeah, for sure. I remember the Death of the Executioner was very well done, you know, considered it back in the day.
That didn't happen in this issue.
It was a pretty heavy issue.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but that's why she's so bummed out.
Right.
Is that she's still getting over, because they were the Asgardian power couple.
Yep. In summer of 1990, Captain America would reach issue 375. And it's part four of the 7-part Streets of Poison story arc, which ran biweekly through the summer of 1990 in issues 372 to 378.
I mean, that is very early 90s to have a biweekly saga, but to just have a random issue be a random part, the year 375 is weird.
It is. They ran in all of these issues, there would be a 17-page lead, almost a full story by today's comic standards, and a 5-page backup serial that featured Battlestar. Written by Mark Gruenwald, with art by Ron Lim and Danny Bullinati, with the backup being by Mark Bagley, and Don Hudson. The deal with the Streets of Poison was that Cap gets caught in an explosion in a crystal meth lab, and the drug bonds with his super soldier serum, and it acts like red kryptonite, basically. It makes them all uninhibited, bold, and ultimately dangerous.
So that's why he's eating at an Italian restaurant?
Well, I guess I had forgotten how long. I was like the Diamondback story.
Yeah.
I guess I always thought that was just like a year or something, but
no.
I'm guessing it was actually quite a few years that went on. I thought she was an excellent kind of...
Agreed. Temptation for Cap, right? Because she was a bad guy, but she's trying to be good, and he's Cap, and he's symbolic, and does he look past her
and
times
this is
that
right
she makes mistakes?
Cap. This is right before Cap gets huge. I mean, if you look at some of those 90s covers after this.
Well, this, I like he beats up Jerkweed Wiederman's gang, then boldly confronts the Kingpin, like Kevin said. He even, eats fries off his plate, basically.
Yeah.
And then when Daredevil tries to talk to Cap, he quickly gets all paranoid and hostile and fights Daredevil for, 5 pages. Meanwhile, Bullseye's on their trail, and Crossbones is, too. There's some cool stuff to come in this biweekly serial arc, but it all leads up to Cap having to give up the soldier serum, which became a metaphor for coming out of the 80s, Just Say No, where there was some criticism of Cap being that, isn't he a hero because of a drug?
Pharmaceutical.
They got rid of the super soldier serum and made him non-super.
See, I would have pitched it the other way. Just have him keep doing crystal meth instead.
Yeah. It's now I'm the new John Walker. Move over, John Walker.
I would have had him design a giant golden suit of armor.
That's coming, but it's going to be blue.
Exactly.
The backup featuring Battlestar is an odd mirror of the ultimate outcome of this Streets of Poison storyline of the getting the Super Soldier Serum out of Cap's body, because Battlestar in this segment is captured by Malice, the scientist who powered him up in the first place, and he's strapped to a lab table and he's about to be depowered.
I always thought that was a fun, for those not aware, Marvel was capitalizing on the wrestling craze of the 80s, so they created the Power Broker, who could amp you up so they could create a whole string of power for the Unlimited League wrestling and all that.
D-Man.
And I always thought it was interesting to have that as a thing to be like, hey, kids love wrestling. What if we had a bunch of wrestling superheroes?
Glad I missed that whole era.
Screaming Mimi.
When I left the thing, he was still just come back from Battle World. Later that year, in the fall of 1990, Incredible Hulk hit 375. It's Night of the Living Skrulls by Peter David, with art by Dale Keown and Bob McLeod. Wow.
Yeah.
This is good-looking stuff, including a cool Grey Hulk versus the Super Skrull cover.
Yeah, this is just before that whole transformation issue, so you have the locked doors and the brain and all that stuff.
Right. It's like, it's the time when the Hulk Smash Hulk and the less powerful, more cunning Grey Hulk were both trapped in, like, a physical manifestation of Banner's mind and vying for dominance back and forth. And this, I really like this issue. It really reminded me of a lot of what I liked about Peter David's run, which was how he handled Rick Jones. Here, Rick Jones get captured by the Skrulls, who, of course, want him to try to harness that power that he used that one time way back in the original Kree-Skrull War. And they don't realize that it's actually Rick. They think it's a Skrull mimicking himself to look like Rick at first. So he gets a little bit of access of kind of hearing them talk for a while before he has to try to escape. And they watch from their base as the Super Skrull picks on Bruce Banner and Betty, who are also looking for Rick. And so with the Hulk Smash Hulk and the Grey Hulk trying to get out, Banner ultimately lets out the Grey Hulk to fight the Super Skrull and save Betty, and we get 10 pages of the Hulk versus Super Skrull, which is just really fun stuff.
Well, he tries to punch that one Skrull's head off.
Yeah, boing! Well, that's the Super Skrull. He's using his, his Reed Richards elastic power.
I love the fight between Hulk, because, they homage and reference all the fights with the Thing and the Hulk. Unlike you, Steve, though, I could have skipped the Rick Jones.
Oh, come on.
Like, I feel like he makes the Skrulls like the Three Stooges or something.
Yeah, but that's
and
fun.
They fall for, like, these lame bits, and I'm like, I kind of like the Skrulls as kind of badasses rather than like jokes.
Rick was trained by Captain America, for Pete's sake.
Ugh, please. Enough with that guy. There's my what if. Why couldn't we not have Rick Jones for a little while? But I've also never liked the
Boo.
Teen Brigade or the CB Gang or whatever he's calling himself. So,
well, they're the cell phone gang now.
Yeah. So that's my... But as you say, if you're going to have it, it's as well done as you can. I am just not a Rick Jones guy. That we need a teen entry to the story was never
all right
for me.
I got you curmudgeon.
Hey, if I wanted the teen entry point, there's another company that's all they do. Hey,
you got 10 pages of the Hulk versus Super Skrull here.
That part is awesome.
Like, remember when the story, like the plot of the book, was the fight actually taking place? Like that's fun.
Yeah, I mean, you have the Super Skrull, always a fun visual treat. because you can kind of throw out worrying about proportions or whatever, because it's always like half on fire and half the thing and half invisible, and I loved all that. The visual depictions of him, I think, is impossible to do wrong.
So this is a fine-ish during one of the finest Hulk runs. What are your other, you know, people think highly of the Peter David run. What's another favorite Hulk run of your guys'?
Like Planet Hulk.
Oh, all right. The Greg Pak stuff?
Yeah. Or then...
I thought you were going to say Immortal Hulk.
I would.
I mean, that's obvious. But that was like, really... That hasn't finished, but still. Or then, I know it gets a little weird, but still some of that Bruce Jones stuff is
absolutely
solid.
That's one of my favorites, too. Yep.
I like the Goofy, when he first gets his brain back and puts his team together, and then there's the Hulkbuster squad and all that stuff, and the armor, and I don't know, I just thought it was like a fun Doc Samson comes back. I don't know, when the Hulk's smarter, it can be a lot of fun, I feel like. Not that, like, dumb Hulk is great for big punch-up issues, but I like the weird little Hulkbuster squad. And
yeah, I feel like dumb Hulk has an expiry date. So then when he goes to, like, the crossroads or something, things get more interesting.
That was interesting when it happened, that's for sure. And I liked the Mignola art on those first few issues. A few years later, in early 1993, there would be two issue 375s that would hit. The first being the Fantastic Four, written by Tom DeFalco, with art by Paul Ryan and Danny Bullinati.
I believe I bought both of these off the stands.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Well,
sadly, I think this was my last Fantastic Four issue, though.
Boo.
Because I think the next one was bagged with Dirtbag Magazine or something. So I didn't want to pay the extra money.
You know of my affinity for this run. I think DeFalco and Ryan's run is not just a top five, but actually like a top three in FF runs.
I think you're the biggest fan of this run that I know of.
Their strategy was great. It was introduce one new character or element every issue. So the thing just kept building and building with fast-paced action. I think it only took a few issues into the run before it was a top-of-the-stack book for me.
And then an issue with Doctor Doom. I'm like, I've been a big Doom guy. Like, how can I skip this issue?
And the Watcher, too. He's always fun.
Yeah, I feel like the cover, though, it really doesn't come off well.
It's so 90s.
So you don't really get the foil thing going on with Marvel Unlimited.
The issue featured a prismatic foil-enhanced cover that was so 90s. It's got legs, big guns, flak jackets. Funny.
I like how you're like, enhanced.
Uatu,
type of enhancement, I guess.
This issue, the Watcher transports the Fantastic Four to his citadel on the moon, and Doom is there, and he's just harnessed the power of the rogue Watcher, Aaron, using that cosmic siphoning device that he used way back on the Silver Surfer. And the Thing's face is all scarred up from a fight with Wolverine and the Secret Defenders last issue. He takes a further pounding and more damage to his face and sees a like statue tribute to them as they were when they first appeared in the Watcher's hallways. And he uses the old helmet that he used way back when. So he gets the retro look, but it's still plot driven, which made it seem like less of a stunt. Then they've got to fight Cosmic Doom, but they're on the moon, so of course they get the help of the Inhumans, right? I mean, there's just stuff coming. You get the Thing's changing his look, you get the Inhumans come in. It all ends, of course, with Reed making some kind of doohickey that Black Bolt has to talk into that amplifies his waves enough to blast Doom all the way back to Latveria.
A megaphone. For lack of a better word.
It's always a megaphone.
This is what, like you say, this is still the fun era of like a ton of exposition and plot overlaying the fight scenes.
Yep.
So Fantastic Four, more like Fantastic Six, Steve, because you have Johnny and his bride fighting the whole time, and there's lots of fun.
There's a lot of characterization going on, despite all the stuff going on, too. And then back home, Franklin's getting all, like, powered up again, and Nathaniel Richards shows up.
It's so weird.
It's his first appearance in 100 issues. It's his first appearance since his first appearance. That's how cool that is.
Well, I like, and I'm sure Kevin did too, you noticed that Franklin's toys, he has a Starship Enterprise from Star Trek. And one of the, it was a TV show by Henson, Dinosaurs, and he has one of the dinosaur kid toys as well. I love when they work like real toys and other properties into their things, but I'm like, boy, Star Trek, what, you think it would have been Star Wars that they would have had, but, you know.
I was surprised at the elder abuse, and then Nathan L. Richards shows up like Cable. He's just like, "Hey, I'm time traveling, and some stuff is going down."
And you know he's going to take Franklin, and Franklin's going to age to that teen. I mean, this was a fun run. All right. Also, in early 1993, Amazing Spider-Man reached issue 375. It's the Bride of Venom. And this issue...
This is actually a book that's gotten some people's attention because of the movie and everything.
Really?
I think... I believe this is the first appearance of any?
Yeah.
Because bringing back Peter's parents was never a spotlight.
Yeah, but that had been going on for at least a little while and would go on for almost another 20 issues, right?
Yeah. I think it started in 365 because that was like the 30th anniversary thing, and then they're like, maybe his parents are back, and I'm like, such a weird.
And then it ended right before 400, I think, if I'm not mistaken, like 396 or something along those lines.
Yeah. I think that was another foil border issue.
Written by David Michelinie with art by Mark Bagley and Randy Emberlin, Venom has kidnapped Peter Parker's recently returned parents to protect them from Spider-Man.
Of course.
Bagley, though, does a fun job with, Venom is a good one for him.
Yeah.
With his exaggerated poses and all the teeth and tendrils and all that stuff. I think Bagley is well suited for Venom.
Not enough green spit, though.
Yeah. And he does a good battle-damaged Spidey, doesn't he? Like, Spidey's got a torn-up uniform the whole issue, but it looks pretty cool. Spidey's searching for Venom and finds Eddie Brock's ex-wife, who gives her whole story and then, of course, provides a much-needed clue that leads to Spidey finding their whereabouts. But Silver Sable's Wild Pack is also on Venom's trail, and they show up with their guns a-blazin' just after Spidey arrives and, possibly was going to resolve the matter without a fight, right? But then, pow, it's 13 pages of Spidey versus Venom versus the Wild Pack versus Spidey versus... when the plot is the fight taking place... I don't mind so much real estate being taken. It's just page after page. I'm like, and then this. I'm like, this is action in comics. Man, oh, man.
Yeah. It's weird because wasn't Silver Sable just before this trying to arrest, Johnny Storm?
Right, because she Johnny Storm accidentally burnt down Empire State University. And was being hunted down.
Yeah, so they're getting a lot of work.
I like that Battlestar is part of the crew. So this is the Battlestar is the secret thread tying this all together.
Yeah.
And then it says the final confrontation between Venom and Spidey, and then it seems like they're not going to even fight. And Venom shows up in this weird, his costume is like a leather jacket.
Yep.
And everything.
It's Agent Venom. They were this close to approving that to be sold in stores. Agent Venom.
Well, it all ends when Spidey helps Eddie and Venom save his ex, who wandered into danger. and ends with the ceasefire deal that forever changes Venom.
Yeah.
Because it leads directly into that first Lethal Protector limited series where he's portrayed heroically.
Well, sort of.
He's hungry all the time, Steve. Gotta eat.
Gotta have some brains.
There's also three backup stories. There's a Spidey Torch story where Spidey is given an overture by Silver Sable to help bring down the Human Torch, but instead goes out to, like, kind of check in on him. Then there's a John Jameson story where, like, he's not the Man-Wolf anymore and he no longer is working for the Avengers, so what is he gonna do with his life? And lastly, a Chameleon story where the Chameleon is hanging out at his pal Kraven's grave and just totally wanting revenge for what happened to Kraven.
Yeah, foreshadowing.
And that one has Aaron Lopresti art, which is kind of cool. All right.
Yeah, it's weird. Those weren't on in the Unlimited.
Yeah, no, just, like, the lead story.
Did they not reprint those in the...
I guess the Digimon doesn't have it.
Or maybe this was done... when was it added? It was added in 2013. So maybe this hasn't been reprinted lately. So this was their first pass through. Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
And they're going to have to add that later.
The next year, in the spring of 1994, the Avengers reached 375. This is written by Bob Harris with art by Steve Epting and Tom Palmer under a really nice wraparound cover.
Mary.
It's the last gathering, which is the conclusion of the long-running threat of the Gatherers, who were a group of alternate reality Avengers that began 2.5 years prior, real time, in Avengers 343.
Well, that's what I like about you, Steve. You're a student of the genre. Like, I know you've studied the Proctor. Some might even call you a proctorologist, Steve.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm always sticking my head where it doesn't belong. Proctor and the Gatherers, having corrupted the eternal, now Avenger Circe, lead an all-out attack on the Avengers, who at this time are Captain America, the Black Knight, Crystal, Hercules, Thunderstrike, Giant Man, the Vision, and Circe.
That's still a good lineup.
Very. I always liked the Circe. I thought was a really fun character. Yeah.
In this run, I thought she and Crystal and Black Knight were all handled really interesting as a little love triangle. And then with Quicksilver coming in and out, too, and them all having to deal with that, there was a lot of good characterization during this run. I think they really tried to X-Menize the Avengers by having the X-Men's group editor write the book. In this story, during the battle, the Black Knight realizes finally that the Proctor, that he's the template for the Proctor, and the Proctor is him, and he takes him on mano a mano.
Yeah, but I'm always forgetting that Gilgamesh was in that line.
he was way back in Walt Simonson's in 300.
I know, but he's the forgotten.
He was with Reed and Sue,
gag, you know, like the forgotten.
He's the forgotten one.
Forgetting that he was in it. Yeah, I enjoyed it, like, the rest of those bohabs went down off panel almost. Like, it was really the Proctor fight. And I'm like, that was instead of Thunderstrike somehow using his tornado to push people away, which sounds very dangerous and not very healthy, I would have just had them, you know, boxing these buffoons over. You know, it would have been nice to see them get their comeuppance.
You see them all get, like you said, knocked out, beaten by the Avengers, but then everything focuses on the Circe Proctor stuff because they have to break the spell on Circe and win the day, and then Proctor dies, you know, when Circe kills him. And then you don't ever see the rest of the Gatherers again. It's really, it's
Yeah, that it just seemed like, yeah, they disappeared. But
there's no shield showing up, taking them in manacles or anything like that.
Well, remember, you can always tell the good guys they're in the matching jackets.
Cersei, at the end of the issue, has to banish herself to another reality to overcome the darkness Malibu. That she's been infected with. And the Black Knight goes with her into exile. And it's like, that's the end of Cersei as we knew her, as well as the end of what I think is the greatest Black Knight character arc of all time. It was cool, too. Uatu, the Watcher, restores the destroyed Avengers complex by substituting in an alternate reality Avengers mansion, but like back from when it was their original Avengers mansion. So it's as if they, you know, retro had the old mansion built on that same site, which is kind of cool.
Well, the opening panel did have me reaching for what date this was published. So, glad to see the Watcher can fix things. And this one did reprint the backup feature.
Yeah. This is a weird backup written by Ben Robb with art by Nancy Labatt and Marina Beccari. It's a Giant Man story where the Black Widow helps Giant Man experiment with some like headgear that makes him hallucinate being on trial by ants for like crimes against the insect world. It's like, no. My worst nightmare. All right, Kevin. In the spring of 1998, here's the Daredevil 375, written by Joe Kelly, assisted by Chris Claremont, with pencils by, are you ready? Cary Nord.
This is a lot.
Ariel Olivetti, John Paul Leone, Tom Lyle, Brian Denham, and Rick Leonardi.
Yeah. You know what the funny thing is, Steve? If I would have continued doing the Daredevil solo bits, this would have been the last issue in that segment run.
Is this the end of Joe Kelly's run?
Yeah, like after this, it's the four-part Bob Dell where he gets his sight back.
Oh gosh, yeah, I remember that.
As I was reading this on the Unlimited, I kept checking. I'm like, did they mess up? Like, is this a different issue? The art changes so dramatic as you're flipping through. You're like, wait, is this even the same book? All of a sudden it flips to something that looks,
they didn't even try.
Obviously a keener viewer other than myself will put together the thematic use of the different artists, but to me it felt hella disjointed. And I'm like, wait, what? Is there a reason? You know, I'm trying to figure out the reason for the art shift, or if there's something going on that I don't know about. But
all of a sudden, Mr. Fear is jacked up.
But no, I think I really enjoyed this story, like the run up to this. But
I did
the
too.
Ending is a little weird.
It's yet another attempt to break Matt Murdock, right? And which we've seen before and since, and it's more courtroom drama, Daredevil style, which we've also seen before and since, but it's still well done and entertaining enough, I think. Here, Karen Page is on trial for murder, and Matt and Foggy are her defense team, because Mr. Fear was tormenting Karen by calling into her radio show, creating this, like, stalker murder persona that led to her getting police protection, but the cop was working for Mr. Fear, and Karen ends up shooting him dead, the cop, which, of course, doesn't look good.
Also, maybe they could have put a few extra pounds on Foggy. Really hate when they have thin Foggy in these things.
Yeah, he does look a little thin here.
Give that guy a sandwich.
Just a good tailor. So Matt has to suck it up and fight his way uphill, both in and out of the courtroom. Of course, he finally finds Fear and knocks him silly, but it's a dramatic issue. There's a lot of reference to like the pressure of like public opinion and where it stands. It shows news commentary and debate about the trial, and one of the guests is actually Mr. Fear in his civilian guise, just adding fuel to the fire, right?
I like Mr. Fear as a bad guy. I feel that this art team didn't... Like, I like when he's a little more horror, a little less jacked, super dude. would have, you know, lean into that element of it. He can look pretty creepy, and with the fear power, that's a nice team up, as opposed to just, you know, jacked dude in the union suit.
I mean, the art was really good on this run, and then you get like this random combination of people in the last issue of the run.
It reminded me, not the art, but the story itself and the dramaticness of it, reminded me a lot of my beloved Moon Knight 25 from that first series with the Black Spectre, you know, turning Moon Knight's world upside down and everything, and the public opinion and all that stuff. It was cool.
I can see that, yeah.
All right, lastly, in the fall of 1999...
Oh, I also bought this off the stands.
The Uncanny X-Men reached issue 375.
What kind of cover is this, though? Like, it looks like Wolverine's dead, and, like, Xavier's performing an autopsy?
Pretty much. This is a weird one, and I think it really reflects 90s X-Men comics.
Oh, boy, does it ever. I can't believe they waste most of the issue on this. Like, what is happening?
It was fun for me because I'm not into the 90s X-Men as much, so it's such crazy dense continuity that it was great just reading a random issue of the 90s.
That's why I thought this would be a fun exercise, because it's like 375s weren't always, a big linchpin for, you know, like we said before, a milestone or considered an anniversary. So I just felt like it would be sort of random issues from different times in these series and give us just a little glimpse of what's going on and give us a chance to talk about different eras and stuff. This is the plot is by Alan Davis with a script by Terry Cavanaugh.
Yeah. And the
art is Adam Kubert with inks by Matt Banning and Tim Townsend. So Wolverine's been killed by one of Apocalypse's horsemen. And they've got his body on a slab and they're looking for clues. Then Professor X attacks Jean Grey, and Cyclops fights back and attacks Professor X, and then before you know it, it's like an all-out mutant-on-mutant melee that winds up with most of the X-Men dead.
Yeah, the final X-Men story.
But I feel also like some of the art is not as even. And like, I don't know if there was time crunch or what. Like, some pages I feel are really super tight, and other ones feel like maybe they were in a hurry to...
Well, giant size? Maybe that's why?
Yeah. I mean, I don't... you guys can disagree or whatever, but some of them I'm like, well, that's a really well-composed and all the... And then other ones I'm like, whoa, looks like somebody needed to finish up.
Yeah, I was like, I remember reading this and then thinking, okay, yeah, maybe Marrow's dead or whoever, like, who cares? And as more and more X-Men keep on dying, you're like, wait, am I reading this story? Like, what's going to happen? How are they going to get out of this one?
Don't worry, Kevin. It was all a ruse forced into the brains of everyone there by Professor X. It was a test.
He's such a nice guy, too. He's amazing. Right?
It was a test to make sure there were no infiltrators. Well, infiltrators?
The greatest, most powerful psychic in the world figure that out?
No, because then it's revealed that the dead Wolverine is a Skrull. Stinking Skrulls. And we've seen the Skrulls get around Professor X's detection before. So where's the real Wolverine? Who are the 12? It all leads up to a final confrontation in issue 379 where Cyclops dies defeating Apocalypse. Remember all that search for Cyclops stuff that happened after?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Which we will never cover, probably.
Nope.
What's funny is the 37... I did not read them, but the 376 cover is the classic Marvel anniversary cover with all the heads, floating heads, and I'm like, shouldn't that have been 375? Like, that's what you do for your anniversary. You put all the little floating heads on it.
No, those are all the heads asking who the 12 is. Who's the 12? They mentioned it so many issues ago.
Yeah, like they sort of dropped that, and then it's like years later, someone's like, hey, what about that old story?
Yep. Funny. All right, that is the Marvel issue 375s. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks, Kevin. Pretty cool. Next issue...
get weirder from here.
Exactly, because next episode starts our October-flavored programming with early issues featuring the Man-Thing and more vampires than you can shake a crucifix at with the Vampire Tales, that black-and-white Marvel magazine. Should be cool. And speaking of autumn... until NFL Super Pro reaches his own issue 375.
Oh,
make mine Marvel. Later.
I'm holding out for US 1, personally, Steve. Less licensing issues.
Maybe they can reach issue 37.
I thought of Team America first, but then it was, it's NFL season.
Okay, out there in Marvel-land, face front, this is Stan Lee speaking. You've probably never heard a record like this before because no one would be nutty enough to make one with a bunch of offbeat artists, so anything is liable to happen.
Hey, who made you a disc jockey, Lee?
Well, Jolly Jack Kirby, say a few words to the fans, Jackson.
Okay, a few words.
Look, pal, I'll take care of the humor around here.
You've been using the same gags over and over for years.
Well, you can't accuse me of being fickle, can you? By the way, Jack, the readers have been complaining about Sue's hairdo again.
What am I supposed to do? Be a hairdresser? Next time I'll draw her bald-headed.
Boy, I'm glad we caught you when you were in a good mood.
Oh, Stan, do you have a few minutes?
For our fabulous gal Friday? Sure. Say hello to the fans, Flo Steinberg.
Hello, fans. It's very nice to meet you. As Marvel's corresponding secretary, I feel as though I know most of you from your letters. By the way, Saul Brodsky wants to say a few words.
Saul Brodsky? Who's he?
Stan, the fans know you have a bad memory by all the mistakes you make, but this is ridiculous. He's been your associate for years.
Really? We ought to start paying him one of these days.
I've been meaning to talk to you about that. And how come I don't get my name plastered all over the mags like you do?
Because I can't spell it, that's why.
Well, as long as you've got a good reason.
Hey, what's all that commotion out there, Sol?
Why, it's Shy Steve Ditko. He heard you making a record and he's got mic fright. Whoops, there he goes.
Out the window again? You know, I'm beginning to think he is Spider-Man.
You mean he isn't?
Who said that?
Just that lovable old letter of me.
It's adorable Addie Simic. What brought you here?
The subway.
Oh, well, ask a bonehead question, Flo.
Stan, Sam Rosen is on the phone.
How are the letterer? My competitor?
Just for fun, Artie, you talk to him.
Hi, Sam. This is Artie. How's it going, pal?
Just great, Artie. I sure admire your lettering.
I admire yours too, Sam. I think you're tops.
Thanks. Well, nice talking to you.
The pleasure was all mine.
I never could stand that guy.
Well, that's our Artie. Just imagine what Sam is saying about him now. Well, let's see who else we can get on this record.
How about Chick Stone?
Okay. Hi, Chick. How's Trix?
Fine, Stan. I'm reading the latest story. It's great. What a thriller.
Now, that's what we like to hear, Chick. Which one of our comics is it?
Who's reading a comic? This is a novel about James Bond. I can't wait to finish it.
Well, we're going to miss Chick around here.
Oh, look who just came in. Kid Daredevil himself, Wally Wood.
Is that a tape recorder, Flo? You know I'm afraid to talk into these machines. I can never think of anything to say. I'm not a big talker. I shut up like a clam. I get struck dumb. My mind goes
okay,
blank.
Okay, forget it. Boy, I'd hate to hear you when you feel like talking.
Stan, Dick Ears is on the phone.
Let's surprise him.
Hi, Dick. We have a recorder playing, and you're talking to millions of people right now.
You're some kind of nut or something? I just want to tell you I want a raise.
Dick, don't you understand? People are listening. You're talking to the whole world.
I always knew you'd crack someday, Lee. Just my luck, it had to happen when I asked you for some more dough. Well, I'm going back to Sergeant Fury. Goodbye.
Another phone call for you, Stan.
Oh, not anymore. I'm getting an earache.
But it's Don Heck.
The idol of the Iron Man fans? The ace of the Avengers? Hi, Don. What's doing?
Stan, I was just wondering, wasn't I supposed to draw Iron Man last week?
Sure. Why do you ask?
So how come you mailed me a Patsy Walker script?
Yipe! Did I do that? That's awful.
Oh, well, don't worry. I'll send it back to you.
That's not why I'm worried. I must have sent your script to Al Hartley. I can just imagine Iron Man looking like Patsy Walker this issue. Okay, talk to you later, Don.
Don't worry about it, Stan. Don't you remember that Al Hartley used to draw adventure strips? It may not be too bad.
Well, well, look who's here. Stan G., our demon colorer. I've been meaning to talk to you, Stan. When are you going to remember it's the Hulk who has green skin, not Captain America?
Gee whiz, a guy can't remember everything. Anyway, I had to tell you what MMMS meant last week, and you're the guy who made it up.
But when I forget something, it's different.
Yeah, it's worse.
Stan, this is the most confused record I ever heard.
Great, Sol. Just what we want. If it were anything else, it wouldn't be the nutty Marvel bullpen.
Gosh, we don't have time for George Bell and Vince Coletta and Larry Lieber and Bob Powell and...
That's great. Now, if we ever form another club, we'll have something new to offer. Voices that haven't been heard yet.
Enough said, Sol. Now, let's all get back to work in the bullpen. And as for you, marvelous Merry Marchers, welcome from all of us to all of you. If you want to know how glad we are to have you with us, just you listen. Okay, let them hear it, gang.
Whoa!
He's a sulky, over-bumpy,
kinda hunky superhero.
Hot to fisted and electrically transistored superhero. An exotically neurotic
and aquatic superhero.
The Marvel superheroes have arrived. Superpowered from the forehead to the toes. Watch them change their very shape before your nose. Arcane striking superhero change to Viking superhero. Dingin' real swinging shield clinging superhero. They're the latest, they're the greatest, ultimatest superhero.